This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For tribal nations, water is considered sacred. It is the source and sustainer of life. It cannot be quantified. In recent years, battles to protect waters that flow through tribal territories have been waged across the nation and right here in North Carolina. Before it was canceled this July, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline Project was slated to run 600 miles of natural gas pipeline from West Virginia through Virginia to eastern North Carolina. The project would have caused disruption to tribal lands and waters, but state-recognized tribal nations were not consulted or considered during the planning. Ryan Emanuel joins us now to talk about a new study he co-authored along with Professor David E. Wilkins about barriers tribal nations face in opposing the initial planning of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Ryan's an associate professor in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources at North Carolina State University. Both he and David Wilkins are also enrolled members of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. Ryan, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Frank. I'm glad to be back.
This July, Dominion Energy and Duke Energy announced the cancellation of their planned energy system, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. How long had they been working on that?
Well, the pipeline was publicly announced just about 6 years ago, around September of 2014. So it had been in the works for many years.
All right. So what part of the pipeline would have disrupted or been gone through the tribal territories in North Carolina?
The southern leg of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was slated to enter North Carolina and Northampton County and travel through the eastern part of the state and terminate in Robeson County. So along the way, the pipeline route intersected either contemporary or traditional lands of the Maharan, the Halawasaponi, the Coharie, and the Lumbee tribes.
All right. And as you say, it had been under consideration for quite some time. How much consideration was given to the members and the leadership of those nations while the conversations were going on?
Yeah, so this was really one of the themes at the heart of our paper. And we did a very detailed study of events and created a timeline that involved actions and interactions by regulators, courts, developers and tribal entities, and we tried to look at the timing and the nature of engagements with tribal nations, specifically the Lumbee tribe, but also others. And what we found was that those interactions didn't start until relatively late in the process. You know, some of the first meetings were in late 2016 or even the summer of 2017. You know, these are years after the project had been announced and the scoping had taken place for the environmental review. You know, by the time many of the tribal leaders learned about this project, there was already a draft environmental impact statement in circulation. So at that point, that's relatively late in the process because regulators have already determined what types of things are going to be covered in the environmental review.
So
and during that, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to make the distinction at this point, and then we'll sort of expand on it. But this is the point at which we should make a distinction between those tribes that have federal recognition and those tribes which may be recognized at the state level, but not federal recognition. So talk about that and what role that may have played in this kind of late consultation.
Exactly. And that is one of the new areas that we explore in this paper, because there's a lot of research and other types of documentation on consultation with federally recognized tribes. And to be clear, that's required by federal law and federal executive order anytime there's an action like an environmental impact statement. And regulators did their job in reaching out to federally recognized tribes. But as you mentioned, in North Carolina, the vast majority of Native peoples belong to state-recognized tribes. And you know, this is an issue because these tribal nations share all the same types of cultural concerns and connections to water, like the ones in your intro. But because they lack that that status with the federal government, regulators are not required by law to conduct the same types of consultation, even though it's advised by advisory boards and bodies that oversee some of these laws and practices.
Well, that raises the question about the state's either responsibility or authority in all of this. Does North Carolina have any formal policy on consulting with indigenous communities before authorizing projects like this?
No, and this is actually one of the recommendations of our study, is that the state of North Carolina, given the large Native American population in the state and the number of state-recognized tribes, we recommended the development of a formal policy on recognition at the state level, and that would just allow transparency and give all parties, regulators, tribes, and developers, clarity on the expectations of parties involved in these proceedings.
And let's pull back a little bit and talk about the importance of water. Obviously, it's critical to all of us, but to indigenous people, why is it so essential for tribal nations to have a stake in water governance?
Yeah, this is a really important issue. And if we look just at eastern North Carolina, the tribal nations that are located in eastern North Carolina today really draw their identities from specific bodies of water. From the Waccamaw Suwan, for example, who live adjacent to Lake Waccamaw, to the Meharan, who live along the Meharan River, the Lumbee, Kahari, and other tribes live predominantly along water bodies that their ancestors lived along. And this is really important because for Lumbee people, for example, our river and our swamps actually protected us and allowed us a place to maintain our culture, maintain our traditions and our communities at a time when the surrounding landscape was being colonized. People were being exploited, lands were being exploited. And so we owe a debt to these rivers and these waterways for protecting and sustaining us and being able to participate in governance, as nations is one of the ways that we can pay that debt forward and ensure that those resources remain for our descendants.
And, of course, one of the things we said was that for those tribes and nations with federal recognition, there has over time been a recognition of that and involvement in the consultation. What historically, though, but give us a sense of some of the reasons that tribal nations had been locked out of planning around development projects.
Well, there's a tendency to adhere to minimum legal standards when it comes to engaging with tribal nations. And so if a tribe is not on the list of now some 570 federal recognized tribes, given all the other demands on the time of regulators who are preparing these environmental reviews and conducting other parts of the authorization, there may be pressure not to go beyond the minimum legal requirements. So best practices and ethical standards may be broader than those legal minimums, but there may be pressure because of time or who knows what to just stick to the legal minimum. And I think that's what probably happened in this case and possibly happened in prior cases.
When those consultations happen, give us a sense of sort of who are the parties. What role do the developers play? What role does the federal government play? And again, maybe we can talk a little bit more about whether the state has much to say at all in a project like this.
Sure. So many people refer to consultation as government-to-government consultation, and that acknowledges that a government, usually the federal government, is interacting directly with a tribal government. Developers may or may not be involved in those discussions, but the purpose is for the decision makers, whether they're state or federal decision makers, to be able to discuss directly with tribal leaders who are speaking on behalf of their citizens. What are some of the technical concerns, even what are some of the moral and ethical concerns that they may have about that project? Maybe they have local knowledge has been passed down through the generations that could improve that project. So it's not always an adversarial conversation, but it is a conversation that is most beneficial when it can happen very early in the planning process. Developers are also free to conduct those types of interactions. I wouldn't frame that as consultation. That's a type of public engagement and outreach that has an importance of its own. But I would draw a distinction and say consultation has to be between a federal and state government and a tribal government.
Well, Ryan, as a practical matter, let's talk about, you know, how this actually plays out. I mean, it's one thing to have a seat at the table, right, and have an authorized role in consultations. But, I mean, talk about the power asymmetries here, an imbalance of power between corporations, federal agencies, and in some cases, indigenous peoples.
Yeah, so you bring up a good point with power asymmetries. You know, with the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, you had powerful multi-billion-dollar corporations proposing this project. You have large state and federal agencies making decisions, and tribal governments are minuscule by comparison. The Lumbee tribe is the largest in the state and has a tribal staff, attorney, elected leaders. You know, other tribes may only have a handful of tribal council members, limited staff, if any. And the tribal leaders are wearing multiple hats. There may not be a dedicated environmental specialist. Or there may not be a dedicated historic preservation specialist. So having a seat at the table also puts some responsibility on tribes to build capacity in these areas to staff up. And that's a tall order for tribes that are already under-resourced in so many different areas.
And, of course, the big question in all of this is the question of environmental justice. And so often we see projects that are placed in minority communities, places where there is less political voice and less political power. And I'm wondering about the role of demographic data. Let's use the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Is racial demographic data considered in the early stages?
In this case, it was not, and we found reporting related to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline where, you know, the developer stated that their initial planning did not use demographic or socioeconomic data. Perhaps the thinking was that we can't be accused of being racist if we don't use these data sets in the initial phase, but I would argue that we really need to be doing the opposite. If we pretend that we're colorblind or we don't see color, it precludes us from being able to address some of the historic inequities that you just mentioned surrounding race and the siting of polluting infrastructure.
Well, and your study also talks about why developers favor southeastern regions. So if they don't necessarily have a database that they collected, certainly they have some idea about where they're going, right? I mean, why have you found southeastern regions are preferred for projects like this?
Well, you know, these projects all have different motivations and different reasons for putting the terminals in various places. You know, this pipeline was slated to terminate in Prospect because there was an important pipeline network point that was routed through Prospect in the 1950s. And when that pipeline was built in the 1950s, there was no EPA. There was no environmental justice policy. And so one thing to consider is if we continue to build on historic inequities without taking those data and taking those considerations into account on the front end, we're just going to perpetuate these historic patterns of environmental injustice.
Well, and the southern end of the Atlantic Pipeline would have been in Robeson County, which is a major indigenous population center. But two of the pipeline's points would also have been driven through predominantly black communities. And you know the developers could have opted to change course as early as 2014 to avoid this, right?
Yes. And so you're talking about Buckingham County, Virginia, and Northampton County, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And those were two very large compressor stations to keep pressure high on the pipeline. And those are both predominantly African-American communities. And, you know, our study did not go into any of the histories of why those sites were picked for those facilities. You know, but I think they do go to illustrate the point that these large industrial facilities, you know, they're sources of air pollution and noise and other types of disturbances are often placed in minority or other marginalized communities.
Now, you have noted that California's policy on consultation has set a precedent that our state and others could follow. Talk about California's policy.
Yeah, so California was the only state that we were able to identify during the course of our research that has an existing state-level policy on state government tribal consultation. And the novel thing or the important thing about their policy is that it applies to tribal nations regardless of their recognition status. And so in North Carolina, something like that would be equally important, you know, in order to take into account all the tribes here that have state recognition but not federal recognition.
Now, what happens in the courts when you run into a jurisdiction problem? The state of California says we have to consult with even those state recognized, and someone says, well, this is a federal project. It's a federal government has jurisdiction here. Your law doesn't apply. Is that a challenge to this?
It could be. You know, we didn't explore that in our work, but I could definitely see that as a place for future research along this vein.
And what are some of the other things in terms of policy that you see as possible, both at the state level but also at the federal level, that could broaden consultation and participation?
Well, one of the things that I think is important is the need for more standardized and rigorous metrics for evaluating environmental justice. Right now, different agencies are free to use any reasonable method for evaluating environmental justice. And there's no standard for determining what's a disproportionately high and adverse impact, for example. And so I think we need to take environmental justice analytics seriously as a policy in the same way that decades ago we began to take seriously the definition and the delineation of streams and wetlands. And of course, that's been a highly contentious topic over the past couple of years with things like the Waters of the United States policies, right? But at least we have a robust policy in that area that we can debate about. And we don't have those same types of analytics right now for environmental justice.
And one of the things you pointed out earlier is that these kinds of consultations aren't always adversarial. There's a way in which the conversation can smooth the path for the developer to point out things that they may not have considered that could be easily taken care of if the consultations start early enough.
Exactly. And I'm not suggesting that could have happened in the case of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, but, you know, if there were a chance for that to happen, you know, maybe 2014 or 2015 would have been the year to test that.
Ryan Emanuel is an associate professor in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources at North Carolina State University. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks, Frank.
You can find links to the research at our website, stateofthings.org.